Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the remote hearing of the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Ms. Hansen, can you please proceed with the roll call for attendance?
Of course. Good morning, everybody. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright? Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Good morning.
Good
Representative
morning.
Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Novotny is present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Schumacher present. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We do have a quorum. Let's see. Representative Noor, would you like to move the minutes from February 24th?
I do, Madam Chair.
Great. Representative Noor moves the minutes from February 24th. Any comments, corrections, or discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the minutes from February 24th, 2021 are approved. Well, members, today we have two bills. I'm assuming the first bill that Representative Noor is presenting will have a lively discussion, and I'm going to give that bill, we'll have an hour for that bill, and then at 11:30, I'm going to end the discussion of that bill and move to Representative McDonald's bill. And members, we are going to be meeting tomorrow, Friday, at 10:30, so if you need to be excused, please let our CLA know, Ms. Hansen. So let's see, Representative Noor, would you like to move House File 1340 to be re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair, and that's my motion to move House File to the Judiciary.
Okay, Representative Noor moves House File 1340 to be re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law. Looks like you also have an amendment. Would you like to move your A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have an A1 amendment. It adds some technical changes and cleans up the bill. At the same time, it also includes some recommendations that the stakeholders and the agency have worked out. So it actually makes the bill in a shape that we can move forward with it.
Okay, Representative Noor moves the A1 amendment to House File 1340. And we do have a question, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it A1 or A21?
I'm sorry. Is it A21? It's A21. You are correct. Thank you for that correction, Representative Mueller. Representative Noor moves the A21 amendment to House File 1340. Any other questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A21 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Two-year bill, Representative Noor, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill before you today cleans up the language we passed in 2020, which implements the Family First in Minnesota.
Over, Dr. Fauci.
It applies a Family First requirement to Minnesota voluntary foster care laws. This bill also creates a certification process for qualified residential treatment program, QRTP, in compliance with the Family First Prevention Services Act. Madam Chair and members, this bill contains provisions that will bring the state into compliance with the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, which is going to be effective nationwide on October 21, 2021. The Family First Prevention Services Act redirects federal funds to provide services to keep children safely with their families and their parents and out of foster care. And when foster care is needed, allows for federal reimbursement for care in family-based setting and certain residential treatment, as I mentioned to you, programs, especially for children with emotional and behavioral disturbance requiring special treatment. With that, Madam Chair, I do have the department, which is going to help us understand the details of this bill. Madam Chair, if you'll allow for the department to present the bill as is.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. We have Assistant Commissioner Lisa Bailey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today about the Family First Act. My name is Lisa Bailey, and I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. As Representative Knorr has already described, this bill is essentially housekeeping and clarifying changes to state statutes that were passed in 2020 to implement the Federal Family First Act. And we're doing this in preparation for the October 1st, 2021 implementation deadline. So I have quite a few changes. So I'm just going to go into them at a high level, and then I'll just run through them and then stop for questions. And I have colleagues available as well. The first thing that this does is these changes clarify the QRTP, that's the Qualified Residential Treatment Program requirements related to juvenile court processes. They're technical amendments to last session's legislation to ensure that all Title IV-E court processes are completed for any placement in a Qualified Residential Treatment Program, the QRTP. These changes are recommended in consultation with the Children's Justice Initiative, and they amend the court processes and submissions to provide clarity and specific direction to court and responsible social service agencies to ensure compliance with court reporting requirements under the Family First Act. The bill also clarifies definitions regarding sex trafficked youth or youth at risk of sex trafficking. It defines sexually exploited youth to include the federal definition of sex trafficking. It also applies to prevention services, and or rather these definition changes are required because of the changes required by the federal act. And in order to do that, in order to make these recommendations to you, the department engaged in broad stakeholder engagement efforts to get at the correct definition. The bill also adds new training requirements for all child welfare workers. The training is to identify sex trafficking, sexual exploitation, and risk. And these changes then would bring Minnesota into compliance with federal law, which explicitly requires the training of the child welfare workers, use of the federal definition of sex trafficking, and defining youth at risk of becoming victims of sex trafficking or exploitation. The bill also includes a modification to successful transitions to adulthood. It amends the statute to define youth to comply with new age allowances under the Family First Act. There are also technical amendments throughout the bill for consistency, such as changing child to youth and other such technical changes. The bill amends the statute to give statutory authority to social service agencies to serve this population of youth to comply with the age allowances under the Act. And then there are also some technical amendments to get rid of duplicative language. The proposed changes have something that I think this committee has heard about already, which is to incorporate the QRTP requirements into Chapter 260D. And that amends the language in 260D to ensure that placements in qualified residential treatment programs comply with child placement and court reporting requirements under Family First, and also then allowing the Title IV-E reimbursements to take place. There is a placeholder for AFDC eligibility that's not currently in the bill language, but there is a placeholder. The bill also amends Chapter 245A to include definitions consistent with the federal law as well as Minnesota rules and the new proposed license. The new documentation provision for the children's residential facilities and foster residence settings pertaining to the background studies is included in this. The provision requires among other things, requires a license holder to document the first date of working at the facility And that's, again, in order to demonstrate compliance with the background study requirements under the Family First Act. In order to provide for efficient implementation of the new Family First requirements, we are proposing to add new license certifications to assist in determining program eligibility for Title IV-E for specific residential settings for children. These certifications will be available for children's residential facilities and foster residential settings, licensed by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. The Department of Human Services will issue and monitor these certifications for programs licensed by the Department of Human Services. So those are programs that would already be licensed, but then they would receive this additional certification through this process. It would also apply, as I said, this is for the Department of Human Services, also for the Department of Corrections, counties, and private licensing agencies. And this establishes the certification requirements and the processes for us to monitor the program compliance and address non-compliance. And essentially that's the certification piece is again about that ability to draw down those Title IV-E reimbursements, as well as of course to just ensure compliance in general. So as you can hear, the Family First Act requirements establish stricter standards on congregate foster care settings. And it is the staff's belief and the department's belief rather that Minnesota children who need residential treatment will be better off due to these changes because they'll be receiving these assessments to determine if child's needs can be met with their family or in a foster home. This court oversight of residential treatment and establishment of a permanency team will provide new provisions to ensure that children are placed in a facility that meets their needs and that discharge planning occurs for the children to return home into their community. Children who have specialized needs will have access to more trauma-informed and effective placement options through the development of the specialized resident. So that's a very high-level, quick overview of what we are proposing. I have staff available from Child Safety and Permanency, as well as from the licensing department, and we would stand for any questions you might have.
Representative Venor, I'm not seeing any questions. Would you like to go to your testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't know if you have the advocates. I see Sue.
Yes, I can call. I have a list of your testifiers. Let's see. The first testifier we have is Kirsten Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and your title for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson, and I'm Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of children and family service providers. Family First Prevention Services Act is the most significant reform for federal child welfare funding in a generation. It presents countless challenges for states and provides opportunity to assess and determine what is the children's service continuum that Minnesota children and families most want and need, and how do we build that system together? The bill before you reflects one area of Family First implementation, focusing on intensive treatment services found in congregate care settings. As you've heard, Qualified Residential Treatment Program, QRTP, or one of three exception certifications are required for providers wanting to maintain eligibility to Title IV-E child welfare funding. We have been working with DHS on this language and appreciate many of the changes reflected in the amendment that you've adopted today. There is more work yet to do on the language to prepare Minnesota for successful implementation, work that we intend to do together as we all need this bill to pass in 2021. Four key issues that we are continuing to work with DHS on include appeals processes for parents and guardians. As this new system of assessment is implemented with new decision-making authority vested in the role of a qualified individual, it is important to assure parents and guardians can appeal placement decisions. Aftercare. Family First requires aftercare support for youth transitioning from QRTP level of care back to community life. Minnesota must make plans for aftercare to be meaningful, locally available, and focused on stabilizing and supporting children and families back at home to prevent further intensive placements. Enhancing opportunities for youth transitioning to adulthood. Independent living setting is one of the three allowed exceptions to QRTP. And should be adopted as a certification option in Minnesota. Independent living settings are by nature diverse, and as we see great value in establishing a certification for settings where eligible youth can benefit from structured treatment and support as they gain skills and obtain greater independence in community life. And review current services for children served by disability waiver and child welfare funding. We must assure system changes do not adversely impact key services for being delivered to children and youth whose treatment and support is funded by disability and child welfare resources. These topics are rife with complexity. Children's service providers are not expert in all aspects of our funding and compliance systems. What our children's service providers do bring to this conversation is a commitment to collaboratively build a true continuum of services, from family preservation to intensive services that our children, youth, and families want and need to support their lives today and their healthy futures. We fully support demonstrating compliance with Family First to continue to access federal child welfare funds. We also believe that we can use the challenge and opportunity of Family First Prevention Services Act to creatively envision, design, and build a children's service system that increasingly meets the unique needs of Minnesota children, youth, and families. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Anderson. We appreciate you being here today. The next testifier is Sue Abderholden. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Abderholden. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Last year, when the legislature heard the department's bill to implement Family First, NAMI Minnesota vigorously opposed it. We did not want parents of children with serious mental illnesses to fully go through the child protection door. You directed DHS to meet with stakeholders to see if there was another way. Honestly, the task force didn't really resolve anything. DHS has worked more closely with NAMI recently to address our concerns by making sure that parents are solicited for their opinions as to who to reach out to for the relative search and screening teams and to eliminate some other what we would consider harmful language. There are a few issues remaining, such as allowing parents to appeal a decision by the screening team or the qualified individual and the county if they deny access to residential treatment. To make sure that the aftercare plan actually includes providers in their community, our residential providers are not in every county or even every region of the state, and so it doesn't make sense to make the providers responsible for that. Unfortunately, we still do not have another option for parents of children who have a serious mental illness. You have to understand that the child welfare or child protection lens clouds everything. Even during these task force meetings, when looking at the data for the number of children in voluntary placements due to their mental illness, they were labeled as number of children removed from the home or removal reasons. These are not children who were removed from their home. These are children who were placed into mental health residential treatment. And that's why we're so concerned about putting families through this door. As some of you know, NAMI is working on a bill, House File 944, that was heard yesterday to really try to create a separate path. If we don't use 4E funds, families won't have to go through relative searches and screening teams. But it's more complicated than we thought, and it might take more time to develop the right and real solution. And we are going to work with MACSA on that. And I just want to remind people that for any other level of care, hospital, PRTF, and private insurance for residential, access is determined by medical necessity. Only for children on MA or children uninsured do you have to go through child welfare to access residential treatment. We aren't going to oppose this bill, but frankly, we're not going to support it either. We'll just stay neutral. But I just want to encourage the committee that we must find another path for these families. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. It looks like Chair Liebling has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, thank you for that. I just wondered if you have any rough ballpark estimate, or maybe DHS does, of how many families are in that bucket that you were just describing, just to give us a sense of the scale of this. Can you do that?
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, in looking at some of the charts that they provided through the task force, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was around 700 families, and the Title IV-E dollars were a little over $2 million, and then the county dollars were about $35, $36
million. Madam Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the 700, Ms. Abderholden, would that be, is that sort of a prevalence? number? Like that's how many there are right now who fall in that? Or is that kind of how many there might be a year? Or I'm just sort of trying to get my arms around I get the severity of the issue. I'm just trying to get my arms around the scope of the issue.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm looking for the chart.
It's okay if you don't have it right now, but, or maybe Ms. Bailey could help with that.
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't have that number right now. I know that the numbers Ms. Abderholden quoted in terms of the funds, I believe that is appropriate. That is correct. But we will certainly get that for you as soon as we can. And if I have it at the end of the hearing, I'll get that to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Not seeing any other questions. We'll move on to the next testifier. We have Cynthia Slowiak. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Slowiak. I'm a human services manager at Hennepin County Human Services. I am testifying today on behalf of MACSA. From the perspective of counties, the way this legislation stands with the set aside of the youth placed under 260D creates significant problems in ensuring oversight, accessing the proper services, and the ability of counties to capture 4E revenue for these placements. Therefore, it is MACSA's position that the youth placed under 260D should be included in the Families First legislation. Our position is based on three primary reasons. First, the federal legislation provides protections for the youth when they are placed out of the home. These protections ensure that the youth is getting the appropriate level of care in the least restrictive environment, and that level of care is monitored by county staff and court oversight. This ensures that the child gets their needs met and that there's adequate emphasis placed on reintegrating the child back into their home and community in the shortest amount of time possible. The second reason is that 260D covers a broader spectrum of placements other than just residential treatment. The provisions under 260D cover treatment placements for youth placed in group homes and corporate foster homes. These placements are to meet the developmental and mental health needs of these youth. By removing all the youth covered under 260D, the cost of these services would be shifted to counties. And counties are not in a position to absorb the additional costs. Thirdly, inclusion of children placed under 260D in the federal Families First federal legislation allows counties to capture the 4E revenue. Counties recognize the advocacy agency's concerns regarding some of the requirements under Families First for youth being placed voluntarily in residential treatment. At the same time, counties have concerns and reservations about developing an alternative pathway for accessing and paying for residential treatment. We recognize a proposal was heard yesterday in the Behavioral Health Committee. Counties would welcome the opportunity to participate in discussions related to the development of this alternative pathway to prevent unnecessary duplication of protocols that would need to be implemented at the local level to ensure protections for the youth in placement continue and to support the parents' right to advocate for their needs of their child. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Slowiak. The next testifier is Matt Freeman. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and I'm testifying today on behalf of our members human service directors from all 87 counties regarding several still outstanding concerns about the Family First overall implementation. First, to echo Ms. Slowiak shared, how the statute stands now sets 260D voluntary placements outside of QRTP requirements, creating those problems both in regard to proper oversight and access to service and payment for cost of service. So the legislature not taking action this session would have negative consequences for services and funding. So we really thank Representative Knorr for authoring this bill and overall support this package. However, even with this change, counties know that they will not be able to access Title IV-E reimbursements if providers or facilities do not become QRTP compliant. And so counties remain committed to preventing and limiting out-of-home placements, but we know that out-of-home placements will still occur, meaning the cost for these placements would fall more heavily on county levy dollars. And we'll continue to work with DHS and providers to support providers meeting QRTP requirements, but want to flag this concern generally and may need legislature support in addressing this issue going forward. Second, I wanted to just flag that MACSA members also highlighted a concern about today's amendment and its potential impact on the composition of the permanency team. We want to make sure that the permanency team foremost functions in the best interest of the child. And we have concerns about the prospects of only allowing individuals that align with parents' perceptions or requests to be included on that team. At the least, we think it makes sense that treating professionals, example of the child's therapist or family therapist, should be included. And a compelling argument can be made for being proactive about including maternal and paternal relatives if we're able to identify and locate them and it is appropriate. Our understanding is that this language has been a part of an ongoing negotiation with stakeholders in DHS, and DHS is working to convene a conversation for all of us to discuss the issue and hopefully come to a conclusion that meets all parties' needs. And we welcome that opportunity to work out those remaining concerns. Lastly, I would just highlight an issue that has arisen during recent discussions regarding the fiscal impact of Family First beginning in September. DHS has informed counties that the maintenance rate for foster placement in congregate and corporate foster care settings will no longer be determined by the MAPC or the Minnesota Assessment of Parenting Children and Youth rate. Instead, DHS has determined based on implementation that counties will need to each contract with vendors for the maintenance cost of placements. And this approach shifts administrative burdens to counties. This approach also has the potential to create some inconsistencies in practice and rates between counties contracting processes and inefficiencies, especially with organizations that have locations in multiple counties and placements of children outside of their county in order to find locations that meet their needs. There is a recent history of services that have been delivered through individual county contracts being moved to DHS contracting for greater consistency in rates and terms. And concerns about variability that arise from lead county contracts are well known to counties, providers, and DHS. Currently, the MAPC rate sets the maintenance rate for care and treatments and provides stability in maintenance rates under state statute, setting rates and applying rate adjustments statewide. And counties have approached DHS and are hoping to work with them on the best route forward to determine a statewide maintenance rate with the prospects for aligning that with the current MAPC rate. So I raised this today to recognize that legislative action might be needed to authorize a common statewide maintenance rate and to align with the increases in the MAPC rate. So thank you again for the opportunity to support this legislation overall, and we'll continue to work diligently to work out any outstanding concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman, for your testimony today. Please stick around for questions. Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, I have the answer to Representative Liebling's question earlier. I knew it was here somewhere on my desk. So for 2019, there were 558 new cases for 260D, and active cases during that time was 1,270.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We appreciate that. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Knorr. I just had a follow-up question for Mr. Freeman. You mentioned that even if this bill passes, that there would possibly be a disincentive for out-of-home placement if the facilities are not certified through the QRTP process. And I just wondered, you know, is there any reporting requirement on this? Because my concern is that if the county doesn't have, the county will have a financial incentive to place them in these certified facilities so they get the federal reimbursement. It will be a very strong incentive, but I'm not sure that would necessarily always be in the best interest of the child, because it might, those, if there's no certified QRTP facility near the child's home or in their county, you might choose to send them far away just to get the money, right? No, you know, it's just makes economic sense at some level. So how are we going to track this, and how are we going to see how much that incentive is driving decisions about where kids are placed? I'm very concerned about getting reporting on this. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Representative Robbins. Mr. Freeman?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, I want to clarify from my comments. The federal reimbursement for Title IV-E is for the room and board cost for these placements. There is still a significant additional cost that is paid for out of county dollars. I think the numbers that Ms. Abderholden cited were about $2 to $2.5 million in that Title IV-E dollars that counties are eligible for, but $37 to $39 million as the overall cost. So there is not a financial incentive for a county to do an out-of-home placement in that setting, because it would be a significant county levy cost for doing that placement. Overall, I would say our members seek to maintain permanency with someone's family as the top priority, and are seeking to limit the number of out-of-home placements that we can see across the system. Not only for financial reasons, but because we find that that is best for the children and best for the overall welfare of our communities.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. I appreciate that answer, and I share the goal of, you know, keeping kids in their in-home situations, but nevertheless, there are times when residential treatment for mental health is really necessary. And so I just want to make sure that the incentives for that are being carefully monitored. So I would hope that somewhere along the way we would make sure we get reporting language on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins, for the good question. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I'm understanding parts of the bill here right. Services to be provided to youth at the program here, do the youth have to go through Child Protective Services to have access? And I don't know who's best to answer that question.
I think Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Fisher. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Jamie Sorensen, who's the Division Director for Child Safety and Permanency. But I can say the answer is, I'll turn it over to Jamie and let him describe it as well.
Okay, Jamie Sorensen, please introduce yourself and your title for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jamie Sorensen with the Department of Human Services. And there are streams, and so it wouldn't have to be the Child Protection Services system. It would have to be an agency for 4E reimbursement that has some affiliation with the state in terms of a 4E contract. And so it could be through a juvenile justice or behavioral health pathway as well.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, the part of the reasons I'm asking some of the questions is this sounds a little like a one-off of a bill we heard in my division yesterday, where some of the funding sources required kids to go through, families to go through Child Protective Services, be able to access the funding before they could get the services. And so that was a disincentive, and this was sounding a little familiar with that. And so that's why I wanted to kind of ask the question here. So a follow-up question I would have, are there specific sources of funding for the youth that require you having to use Child Protective Services? It feels like that, it sounds like at certain, there might be certain situations where it sounds like the family might have to have Child Protective Services being used before they can get their kids into this program, into the program. Is that correct in some of these situations?
Mr. Sorensen?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, thanks for the question. Some of the federal funding sources are targeted toward youth who are in public child welfare system, you know, which is a fairly broad definition and can include juvenile justice, behavioral health, and child protection. The Title IV-E is a child-specific eligibility, and reimbursability is conditional upon a number of factors related to the work that was done prior to a child being removed from their home, that remaining in the home is contrary to the welfare of the child, and that the facility or the placement within which the child is residing is eligible and reimbursable for 4E. So the Family First Preservation Services Act, which is the primary focus of our work on this at this time, is relative to those kids in facilities where they would be pulling down Title IV-E to help offset the cost of the placement.
Representative Fisher?
First of all, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the testifier. You've given me some to think on. I'm still trying to format here. I might have a couple more questions as we go forward, but thank you for the opportunity to ask the questions.
Ms. Abderholden, do you want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, the way the Family First Bill is set up is that if you're on medical assistance, if you're on anything other than private insurance and your child needs residential treatment, you are going to have to go through this process. I mean, that's what this is all about. Which means whether it's 260D is voluntary placement or 260C, you're going to have to go through this process and have a relative search and have a screening team. And does the department disagree with that? That, I mean, this is what is laid out.
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, that is existing law, and that's the way it happens now. What we are proposing here, and so Ms. Abderholden is correct, absolutely. What we're proposing here is because we're being required by the federal Family First Act requirements to make these changes to the two different sections of the statute, which is 260C, which has to do with the out-of-home placements for children in the child welfare system, and then 260, so involuntary placements rather, and then 260D, which is the children that Ms. Abderholden is addressing right now. Under Family First, we are requesting that both of those sections, that the Family First Act requirements apply to both of those. So that's the change. Right now, they do the requirements Ms. Abderholden laid out, that is current law. So we're asking that the Family First requirements also be added onto that. So she is absolutely correct. And we've been in many discussions about that and about what the alternatives are. So I think Representative Fisher, perhaps you're focusing on those 260D cases and the proposal, the sort of third path. So that applies to that one group of kids, absolutely. What we're talking about is both the involuntary and the voluntary out-of-home.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank you for the explanations. The question I would have would be to Ms. Abderholden, and I appreciate the opportunity to explore this a little bit here, is in the bill that we heard yesterday in the Behavioral Health Division, I know this issue came up, were we able, and I apologize for not being able to remember clearly on everything back and forth, you had highlighted how there was this one group that, you know, for the people to get services for using MA, they had to place their child through protective services. Did we get that problem entirely solved in that bill, or was that still outstanding? And if it was somewhat solved, does some of that work should be applied to this bill right here?
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher. So if we don't use Title IV-E dollars, technically, we don't have to go through family first. But it gets more complicated because there are a ton of county dollars that go into this. And so our bill originally was just looking at the 4E dollars. If we replace them with state dollars, we wouldn't have to go through this. But there are additional families where they're not drawing down 4E and they're county dollars. And that's the part that we have to kind of figure out a little bit more. But what we didn't want is for, and we've told Max of this, we didn't want them to kind of foot the bill basically of not being able to apply for those 4E dollars. So we would want to replace them. I know this gets a little tricky. And, you know, under the current system, families, they don't have to do a relative search. They don't have to show up at court right away. They just file papers. So it is not quite as intense as if you did it under 260C. And that was legislation I worked on over a decade ago. And it was to make sure that families didn't have to relinquish custody and weren't treated as if they abused or neglected their child. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for that explanation. Yes, it is extremely complex, and your explanation helped me out there. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions from members. Representative Nora, would you like to make additional comments or closing comments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I hear your concerns. I hear the concerns from the advocates in regards to Minnesota Family First. I'd like to see more collaboration so we can resolve some of the challenges and also the unintended consequences as we implement the program. I also want to assure you that I will continue to work on this issue so we can bring everybody on board so that we can look into the implementation of FFPSA in the state of Minnesota. However, delays in this proposal will impact federal approval of the Title IV-E plan and implementation of FFPSA and puts federal 4E funding at risk. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File 1340 as amended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Nora. So Representative Nora renews the motion to re-refer House File 1340 as amended to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee as recommended, and we will take a roll call vote. Ms. Hansen, Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Thank you. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Excuse me. Keel, aye.
Thank you. Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Moore?
Yes.
Nora, yes. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Chair Schultz, that's 19 ayes and 0 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion passes and the bill is now re-referred. The last and second bill on our agenda is Representative McDonald's House File 923. I'll move that House File 923 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative McDonald. Please tell us about your bill. I'm not seeing any amendments.
Madam Chair, that is correct. There are no amendments to the bill. Good to be back in front of HHS. I spent about 4 years in my previous terms with HHS, so it's near and dear to my heart still. Here in this very committee and in various settings across the state of Minnesota, there are important conversations taking place about how we as a state can support Minnesota with disabilities to live meaningful lives in our communities, lives based on their own choices and about where and how they live, learn, work, and play. These conversations are resulting in many innovative ideas for how to move towards this shared goal while using state dollars in the most cost-effective way, including ideas for reforming existing programs, integrating and increasing choices for individuals around how they are limited support dollars, and more. However, communities inclusion can only be successful if it is guided by self-advocacy individuals with disabilities. Speaking of which, I need to put my glasses on, pardon me. Self-advocacy individuals with disabilities naming their own vision of what they want with their lives and what they want to look like. That self-advocacy must be the foundation, whether it takes place within their own family, in their place of work or school or living, in their local community or here at the Capitol. Or to put it another way, people with disabilities must share the leadership of this work with their own inclusion. The grants funds proposed in this very bill would support specific activities focused on development of these leadership and self-advocacy skills of Minnesota with disabilities. This bill has been in front of this committee before, and this committee has successfully supported this idea and bill in the past. It's a wonderful bill and a great opportunity for those with disabilities in the state of Minnesota. I'm going to turn it over now to my testifier, Mary Kay Kennedy with ACT, Center for Disability Leadership, to provide a further brief of the testimony on the bill. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Mary Kay Kennedy, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kay Kennedy, and I'm the Executive Director with the ACT Center for Disability Leadership. So I'm really appreciate the opportunity to give testimony today on this bill. So when you think of the rights that folks with disabilities have, and those rights are often written on pieces of paper, and the rights that they actually know about and are supported to exercise, there really is a significant gap there. There's a gap between what their rights are and what they know about. So I wanted to just give the committee just a few examples of really common kinds of things that we see with the folks that we're working with. So at a recent workshop, we were talking about housing, and one of the fellows said, well, I'd really like to move. I'm not happy where I am. But if I moved, I wouldn't have anybody to give me my medications, so I can't move. Another one said that she's not allowed to have any guests in her home. She lives in foster care, and the foster provider says, no, this is my home. If you want to be with your friends, you go out in the community. You can't have anyone in here. Another fella said, you know, I knew I had the right to vote, but I didn't know I had any of these other rights that you're talking about. And then just a final kind of a little example is one of the gals really wanted to go and order out from a local restaurant. And the powers that be said, nope, you're on a calorie restricted diet, and that's just not going to happen. So people really, even though we have wonderful policy and wonderful ideas about the rights that people ought to have in this world, for many, many, many people, they just simply don't know about those rights and are not supported to exercise those rights. So at the ACT Center, we do a couple of things. We administer a statewide network of disability groups of folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we create tons of training for folks. So we create trainings that can go out to every part of our state just to share this message about you have rights and you belong in this world. So for many people with intellectual disabilities, they really have lived in, we kind of call it service bubbles, where they really are not out there interacting with people with and without disabilities. So that's the really great, great news is that when we provide disability supports and disability inclusion supports and self-advocacy training, we really see some really great results. So I don't know if you can see this picture, but it's a picture of one of our groups that joined a community garden. So they joined and they met their neighbors and they started to form relationships and they're sharing and they're weeding the other people's plots and people are coming over to help them. So it's really a fabulous example of people being supported to be part of their community and how everybody really benefits when that happens. So I have just dozens of examples of people starting volunteer clubs, teaching each other how to use Uber and Lyft, getting their phone books out and figuring out, hey, that cousin that I haven't seen for 4 years, I'm gonna call that cousin and see if she wants to go out for a beer. So people, once we kind of get people rolling on this idea of you deserve to be part of community, it's really, we really do see some fabulous results. So basically, I guess in short, our program is trying to narrow that disparity gap between the rights people have and the rights they know about and are supported to exercise, and just to support people to get out there and be regular Joes in the community side by side with everyone else. So basically what this bill will allow us to do is to maintain this statewide network that we have that works beautifully to get the word out to folks about their rights. And some of the funds in this legislation will go directly to the regions across the state so that they can reach more people. So that's always a big issue, the number of people that we're able to reach. And it just allows us to continue with our networking and conferencing, and again, just getting that word out. And it positions our members across the state to continue to be leaders in disability leaders in Minnesota's Olmsted and disability inclusion efforts. So we're super proud of the work and the leadership that folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities have played in Minnesota's integration efforts. So that's it with what I have to say. And we have another testifier who is a member of the ACT Center. She's a facilitator of these trainings that I was just talking about. She's a peer facilitator. She's a member of the, or she's a graduate of the Olmsted Academy. So it's really a powerful, passionate, wonderful Minnesota leader. So I'd like to introduce Cynthia Gales.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. I'll go to questions after this testifier. Cynthia Gales, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Gales, and I'm a part of the ACT team, Advocating Change Together. I just want to say a few things about how the program has empowered my life and made many changes. Before the ACT program was around, I knew nothing about disability rights. I was one of the people that was like, disability rights, what is that? You know, I was always told what to do, when to do it, and how to do it, and was made to feel like it was in my best interest. So once I enrolled in the ACT program, I have become a better person. I know how to now speak up for myself and what I believe. And I always, and now I feel that I do have a choice to live the way I want. You know, I wish that this program was around when I, in my younger days, and my life would have been much, much better. You know, I am now in a program helping people who know nothing about their disability rights. We have an on-hands program that we help people to understand through skits, plays, song, dance. You know, we're just trying to get it out there that just because you're disabled or you have a disability doesn't mean that you can't be treated equally. You know, and the program is excellent. It's excellent, and it works. And not only for me to say that it works, it's been proven that it works. Because in December, I accepted a National Human Rights Educational Award for the ACT program. And that was a really great challenge for me. So yeah, I feel like the program really works. I mean, I'm here to let you know it helped me in my life. and we're helping others in their struggles in their lives. And I just wish that we could continue the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gales, and congratulations on the award. And I'm really grateful. I'm really glad that you received a great benefit from it and continue to do so. So members, there is a fiscal note that was sent out. It's $248,000 annually. And now I will go to questions. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this might be for Ms. Kennedy. I don't know if members are totally familiar with the regional quality councils that have been around for a while. They work on improving quality in disability services, and I don't think they exist everywhere. It's been sort of a growing model, and they do this thing called voice reviews, which is a way of helping people with disabilities evaluating quality in our programs by actually talking to the people who are experiencing the program and asking them what they want and what quality means for them. So my question for Ms. Kennedy is there any interaction between the program you're talking about today and these voice reviews that are done by the quality councils? Does this overlap? Doesn't the voice review kind of try to get at the same thing, maybe from a different angle?
Ms. Kennedy?
Yes, thank you, Representative, and thank you for the question. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think they're the same thing, just coming at it from a little bit different angle. So some of our members have definitely been some of the people that have conducted those voice reviews. And I think it's just about layering so that they do the voice review and then going out into their community and gathering more information and more personal power. So kind of the way we look at just this road to living a higher quality of life is building up your personal power and thinking about how you are part of a bigger system that includes voice reviews and quality assurance and some of the goals of our state and our country in terms of how people with disabilities ought to have more say in their life. And then, you know, just getting out there and enjoying life. So I don't have to kind of back to that question. I'm not, I know that many of our members have been part of those quality reviews and have participated in being the interviewers for measuring quality, but I don't have a deep understanding of all of the aspects of that program.
Chair Liebling.
That's great, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, thank you for bringing this initiative before the committee. I want to pick up on something that Representative Liebling said, and I concur with Representative Liebling. I think it's very important that we look at all programs, but I think there's a key difference that I want to just highlight for the members of the committee. As I listened to the testimony of both Ms. Kennedy and Ms. Gales, I identified that it isn't just about informing individuals about their rights, but I think it's also very, very important that you empower them to train them to have the ability to act on those rights. And there is a clear delineation between those two. And as this program clearly portrays, you are empowering folks that are going through the curriculum to act on those rights in a way that is polite, respectful, and within the realm of reason and sense when they're interacting with the public, as well as moving themselves to have a best life. As we often say in this committee, Chair Schultz, and we talk about the book that we are all hopefully reading at some point, I think it's important that we recognize that the folks that come through these programs, they're looking for an opportunity to make themselves reach their choice of best potential and empower them. And I congratulate Ms. Kennedy and Ms. Gales for doing just that. And I would urge the members of the committee to wholly support this. I understand it's being laid over for possible inclusion, but I would really urge members to really think thoughtfully and positively about this. And again, thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Let's see, Ms. Kennedy, did you want to comment? Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Representative McDonald for closing remarks. I'm not seeing any more questions from members.
Well, Representative, just before, I just would like to comment and just thank Representative McDonald and just note that he doesn't only, Representative McDonald, you don't just work on this on a policy level, you live this. So Representative McDonald is one that comes to our meetings, interacts with our people, has sloppy joes with us, and interacts. So just by example, kind of lives the spirit of what we're trying to do is just form a community where everybody cares about everybody else and is encouraging to everyone. So I just wanted to thank Representative McDonald for that.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Representative McDonald, closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Mary Kay and I have worked together on this for a number of years, and she's wonderful to work with, and she has such a great passion, and you can see from her smiling face that she makes such a big difference in people's lives. And I appreciate the comments by Representative Albright and Liebling as well. This really gives the opportunity for those who have developmentally disability and those with disabilities to take and empower their, and get their lives back and know their rights and empower others with disabilities to know those rights and to really live a quality of life of not segregation, but integration and be involved in the community, be involved in their parishes and their schools, their families and the groups that they live in. And it does wonderful, wonderful things for our for that community. The last time this committee voted and we passed into law was in 2017 for the funds. And as you can see, it's a very limited amount of funds. They're very frugal, very careful with every dollar. But so 2017 was the last time. So it is again time. We would love to, Madam Chair, to have you consider this or actually maybe put it on the top 10 priorities back into the omnibus bill to empower those with disabilities to know their rights and to live a great quality, beautiful life, just like you and me. And with that said, I thank you for the time in the committee and let you know that yes, Mary Kay or Ms. Kennedy, I've been active with the group for a couple of years and it's so refreshing and so beautiful to be with the group and listen to their stories and give hugs and eat sloppy joes and whatever we do to celebrate their life and the victories that the state has allowed them and their families and the great group like ACT has done for them. So thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Always good to be in front of the group, even though it's Zoom, back in HHS. So thank you, and Madam Chair, that's all I have for now.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. So I'm going to renew my motion to lay House File 923 over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Members, I'm not seeing any other questions or comments, and there's no new business. So we will be meeting tomorrow to hear our House File hearing. We're hearing one House File, and we're going to be meeting at 10:30 on Friday. This is not a normal time for the committee hearing, but we're going to be trying to hear as many bills as possible this session and added this additional meeting for the next few weeks. So with that, members, thanks again to our testifiers for coming to explain the bills and their work that they're doing in our communities. We appreciate that. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.